And then she'd blow her nose on her apron and go back in her. All my peers would laugh and comment on this kind of stuff. Now, I had mixed emotions, see, because I loved my grandmother more than I liked these creep kids, and I didn't want that secret to get out because I understood right away about peer pressure, even as a child. And just like, oh, you know, you couldn't tinker too much with them. And I didn't like them laughing, and I didn't like my grandmother doing that. And I didn't know who to hate. And I would just stuff it inside, and I just feel rotten. And the peers would dig at stuff like that, you know. And I developed some kind of a defense against it. I tried to get witty, and I tried to, and then I'd forget what to say, and I'd just punch one of them little suckers. And then I sort of like got a reputation of being witty and dangerous, you know. And I didn't have any drink yet. I was just a little kid, you know. I was starting to be restless, irritable, and discontent. And I didn't even know what it was, but that's the way I felt. I was 8 or 9 years old. My mother remarried, and I got a stepfather that was a cross between Archie Bunker and Adolf Hitler, if you can picture it. He made like a hobby out of knocking the hell out of me. And looking back on it, I made a hobby out of deserving it. You know, I didn't realize it at that time, but I was, and with all this like a junk life to me, this was like a junkie life. Everybody else had a better life. Their dad was a Boy Scout commander, and it seemed, you know, surely it wasn't. There was other, you know, messes like that, but it seemed to me everybody else had it like Ozzie and Harriet or something, and I had this goofy zoo I lived in. And this stepfather, he was something special, and I was terrified of him all the time, just terrified. And, well, I had trouble in school, you know. And I don't think they did anything about those kind of kids. The only thing they did with me is they'd give me a test once in a while, and they'd find out, or they wouldn't find out, but they'd make a determination that I was smarter than the grades I was making. And I couldn't understand why they were singling me out, because I seen the dumb kids, they left them alone. And if I'm making bad grades, I'm a dumb kid. So, you know, you look like a duck, walk like a duck, treat me like a dumb kid. Don't holler at me and make me do stuff. Just let me know they wouldn't do that. You know, they just kept prodding me, and I would drift. My mind would drift, and I wouldn't want to be in school. I wanted to be outside. I didn't want to learn stuff like the capital of Alabama and that. I wanted to know why you couldn't stick a cat's tail in a light socket. You know, it's the kind of things that interest me. And so I just was like restless, and I couldn't get in the mainstream of things, and consequently, I felt like the world was out there like a tiger, and I had a whip and a chair all the time, and I was getting weary. You know, I want somebody else guard the door while I rest, because just them, they want you to do this and eat that, you know. And I couldn't understand about God neither. Why would he make ice cream bad for you and spinach not? You know, I mean, it just was stupid. This is a stupid God. And I would ponder things like that. You know, I would have too much idle time or something. I'd just think about crazy stuff. And I remember hearing a speaker in AA one time saying he was sitting on a railroad bank drinking wine and watching all these trains. And he said that every day 6 trains would go north and one train would come south. And he said, you're going to end up with all your trains up north, you know. And I thought, you know, this kind of thing bothered me. And other people never seem to see that kind of stuff. I just don't understand. That's a different perception, and then people raise their eyebrows when you make comments. So if you're like me, you quit making comments, you know. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell's wrong with that, you know? And it's actually silly. One of the most traumatic, I don't think I ever mentioned this, silly, one of the most traumatic things that I ever remember as a child was so silly that I could hardly say anything about it when I laugh myself today. But I remember I was in a Methodist church, and I don't know how old I was. I must have been only 6 or something like that or something. But the Second World War was coming to an end, or it just ended or something. But they were running the movie The Greatest Story Ever Told, you know. Old grainy black and white, they were showing it. And when they dragged Jesus off to the, you know, I was all into Jesus, and I was the ones in Sunday school that listened. Everybody else would hit me with gum bands because I was looking for something. I was in Sunday school listening and wanting this, you know, because they said this is good stuff. And the other kids, you know, they didn't have a watch, but they couldn't wait to get out of there, and they're just acting up and that. And I'd listen, and they hit me with gum bands and that while I'm watching this movie. Part comes a dragging Christ off, and he's got the thorns in his head, and they're stabbing the side on. I'm thinking all this. See, I'm crying. And I'm trying to not let anybody see me cry, and then they call attention to it. And then everybody laughed, and then I lost it. And there I am, this pathetic little kid, and I'm screaming at the Sunday school. I don't care how loud I got now, see. Like, you don't get loud in church or in Sunday school. And I'm just a kid. And I'm getting loud. And I'm telling them, this wouldn't happen if the Marines were there. You know, I was all pumped full of that Second World War. You know, they were saying things like that. Saying about the Marines and airborne and all that kind of stuff, man. And I visualized the Marines being there and just kicking ass. Take him off that cross and kick ass. And I wanted to believe in something. You know? But I was ridiculed beyond the point of my endurance at that time. And something in me just like closed down. You know? And I got different. So later on when I got this stepfather, my stepfather drank too much. Can you believe that? And he was a hard guy to deal with. He was like a cement block with hair on it. That's what he was. And he used to do crazy drinking type escapades. And I remember one of the things he did was he bought chickens one time. He bought live chickens. And he got a big, like, big cage like full of these live chickens. He brings them home drunk. He tells me to kill the chickens. I'm 10 years old or something, like 11. I never killed a chicken. I'm in the city. You know, I never seen chickens. I don't know if I seen them before that. But anyway, I brought the chickens and I got to kill chickens. I said, I don't know how to kill chickens. So I'll show you how to kill a chicken. He gets a chicken, he puts two nails in a board, sticks its head in there, and he chops its head off. He got these big ham hands of his. He's holding the chicken. The chicken just moving a little bit. See that? And he sticks the chicken in his cardboard box. And he said, it's simple, you know. So he goes to bed. I get the chicken. I got to kill these chickens, you know. I mean, I'm already in... You know, I'm going to get in trouble if I don't do it. Ain't no sense in going to my mother. My son, I don't want to hear it. Do what he says and shut up and whatever. And so I got these chickens and I'm looking at chicken. I said, I like chickens. I don't want to hurt no chicken. But I got it killed. So I take the chicken out and I do what he did. I put it in between those two nails and I chop its head off. And I got these little 11-year-old, 10-year-old hands of mine. And that chicken is gone. Now, chickens, if you ever notice, if you kill a chicken, they do more in that minute than they've done their whole life when that head's gone. And it's running around, it's getting blood on me, and it stinks. I don't know how you can eat chicken. It stinks, and it was a big deal, and I'm disgusted. Now, the next chicken I get out of there, I'm mad. I grabbed that rotten chicken, and I want to cut its head off, man. And I cut its head off, and I throwed it in a box, and I put my foot on top of it, and a thought came to my mind, what am I, some kind of an apprentice serial killer or what? How can my mind just go like that? From all this compassion, 10, 11-year-old boys ain't supposed to think shit like that. And I had, you know, if I knew from past experience, I'd say to my stepfather, hey, listen, I had this, you know, shut up, he'd say. There's a ton of sand up there, move it. You shouldn't think, you know. And I mean, I'd tell my mother's eyes would cross. She'd think I was getting nutsier and she's going to have to put me in a home or something. Because, you know, I was already doing crazy stuff. You know, I threw a can of rocks in a paint can over a hill, sort of like a mortar attack on this neighbor kid. And my mother was getting caught up in my shenanigans, you know. And I'd done things to my mother, too. You know, I learned tricks, and I'd ask when I'd see something interesting. I remember taking every glass in the house and filling it with water and put wax paper on it, put it on the kitchen table and pull the wax paper out. So she'd come home from... Well, I was mad because she was at work. And she'd come home and all her glasses are full of water. And I hid the buckets, too, because I knew that's the first thing she'd want to do was get a bucket so she could pull them over the edge. Well, I fixed that. You know, so she had to use a little pot and pans and stuff to get that out of there. And, but these are the kind of things that come to my mind all the time, you know. And, so by the time I was in junior high school, I was getting into some pretty serious trouble with school. When I went to a nice school with girls and boys, you know, football team and everything nice. And I didn't blend good. And I was into the, well, rock and roll was brand new. I was into it. I played drums. I had a little group. And I had already got in trouble for forging library passes and selling them and smoking cigarettes. And I sold dirty pictures. You can see the same thing on Home Boss today. I was 40 years ahead of my time, you know. But they were really snotty about that in those days. I mean, Jesus, you know. You probably got 5 or 6 years of hard labor for having your fly come undone or something. You know. But anyhow, I was just in trouble all the time. And finally, with this band I had, we had to audition. Now, see, I have an alcoholic mind, so I try to always think what you're going to do with me before I say something. So I got to decide what I want and how you can help me, so that's what I tell you, you know. Because, I mean, there's no sense of telling anybody the truth if there's a shortcut, you know, to get done. You know, like you want somebody out of a house, you tell them it's on fire or something. You tell them, would you come out? I'd like to talk to you. Well, they might not want to talk to you. If you really want them out of there, you got to, you know, tell them there's some kind of hitman or something going in the other door. I mean, expedience is number one, you know. I told this group of teachers that our band was going to play a little tune called Mockingbird Hill with a little silly waltz for them days, and we were going to play on the assembly. So we got down the assembly. Meanwhile, I had rehearsed with my little band, and we had it was a new tune at that time called Night Train. It kicked, and I had a guy on tenor sax. That kid could cook, and we get up on it. They never had that in school yet. You know, I mean, it was 54. And so we got in there, and we started to cook with this funky tune. And, man, all the kids were up on the seats. You know, and I was happy, man. Look at, you know, because rock and roll was like not talking about that. It was just coming. They were doing that in Boston and places where they were really goofy and bad. And so I brought it to this little Swissville high school, you know, in the suburb of Pittsburgh. And, boy, the kids were up in the seats, and the teachers were up in arms, and the first thing I know, I'm going to this Conley Vocational High School, which is in the worst section. You know, when they went to build that high school, they said, where do you have all the hookers and dope and shit? You know, and they said, right over there. That's where the school. And they put that school right there, and the kids fit in perfect. They got all the incorrigible goofs. They put the authorities always put dumb people and crazy people in the same room, and they think there's some logic to that. You know, that don't work. If anybody's into that social stuff, or social helping people or something, just think about that a little bit. If I can be of any service to you, don't put the plumber's opinion. Don't put stupid people and crazy people in the same jar. It's not good. And, but we'd all get in trouble. When I got beat up, they found out my name was Jack Dempsey. I had a hell of a time down there. I didn't know that was going to be, that was a real serious problem, you know. When I say, what's your name? You know, and I'd say, Jack Dempsey. You know, hit him. You know. And you majored in two things down there. You know, there was one major and one minor. You could crime or alcoholism. Whichever you want. I think they've got three curriculums now. They got drugs down there now. But when I was down there, it was just alcoholism and crime. And I majored in alcoholism. Some of the other fellows are probably in jail right now. But I minored in crime now. I was no, you know, I had crime 101, you know, I had a hell of a time down there. And, I finally got out of there. I got married when I was 17 years old, and I got out of there. And I married my childhood sweetheart, who, you know, I love her. I still love her, but I loved her so much then that I thought that she understood everything. You know, and I'd tell her how bad the world was, and she'd just look at me. And I thought she agreed. And I told her all about them, how bad they were. Well, we got married. My God, I married in the enemy camp. She was one of them. And she would just, her eyes would cross over when I'd go into my tirades and speeches and stuff like that, and I scared her. The more I scared her, the madder it made me, because I didn't want her to be scared. I'd say, listen to me. She said, don't raise your voice. You know, we got a side issue we've got to deal with here now about the voice business, you know. So, you know, if I got angry, I got went over the top. I'd end up, the biggest issue in the world was raising my voice now, you know, and I'd just lose it. And then she wouldn't listen to me at all because she was really frightened. But I didn't know she was frightened. I thought she was putting me out, you know, alienating me. So I'd get her attention by grabbing her head or something like this. So she'd listen because she'd move her eyes. She'd want to go. I said, you ain't going. You started saying stuff, now I listen. Then she wouldn't listen. Wouldn't listen. And I tried to tell her what things were, and she just couldn't understand that. But I was 15 years old, and I was down at Conley, and I was bringing in bad reports just before I got married, and I used to forge report cards at a print shop down there. I was in the plumbing shop. Print shop boy would give us report cards, or sell them to us for cigarettes, right? And we'd put the grades we want in there, you know, and I put grades the old bear would buy. You know, I mean, I wasn't stupid enough to put A's in there, but he was gone one day, and I got my report card, and I knew that this time I was going to get it. I had just D's and F's on that report card. And I was afraid to go home, because he had warned me. And I was already in trouble. I left his favorite paintbrush get hard or some damn thing. So that was already a serious offense. And now this report card, I knew he's going to have me gassed or some goddamn thing. And so anyhow, I'm pacing the house and waiting for him to come home from work, and I found his slow gin in the icebox. You know, I was 50 years old. I drank that slow gin. I'm here to tell you, I didn't find an answer to all this. I found the answer. I found the answer to all this stuff I've been whining and crying about here for 10 minutes. Simple as that. It went away. I remember later on arguing with a psychiatrist. I asked the psychiatrist, what the hell? I told him all about these feelings and everything like that. I said, what do you call that? Well, he didn't tell me that was restless, irritable, and discontent. He said to me that was free-floating anxiety. I said, you want me to tell you what happens? Now, just a moment before that, I had set him up to make him criticize me about my drinking. And I said, you remember what you said about my drinking? I said, now, listen to me real good. Don't try to get out from under what I'm saying like my wife always does. I said, that free-floating anxiety, you probably can see, bothers me a lot, you know? But it's not just like a mild twitch or something. Like it's got me to the point of sticking a pistol up my own nose, for Christ's sake. So hear me out. He says, say whatever you want, you know? I'm your doctor. I said, when I drink whiskey, the goddamn free-floating anxiety goes away, you silly son of a bitch. Now, how can you tell me on one hand not to drink whiskey, and on the other hand, you got this free-floating anxiety, what are you going to do about it? You know? I don't care what reason them social drinkers drink, I know they don't feel like I do when I drink. I don't know, they just do cartwheels when that whiskey gets in. I say, yes! I invented the term, all right, you know. But that's what that booze done for me, and I knew from past experience anything that I liked that much nobody else was going to want me to do it. I knew it. Because they didn't want me fooling around with girls. I discovered them in third grade, and boy, what a long wait that was to find it. But then the little tinkering I did along that area was frowned upon. And I find out that anything I liked, get out of the ice cream, stay away from the girls, don't smoke cigarettes. Now this whiskey, I knew that, you know, that booze, they made an effort to stop me from drinking. I took it personally. People would get a drink, go somewhere, and give everybody a drink and say, Jack, you know, there's some kind of qualification with my drink. Well, here's a beer for you, but listen, Jack. You recall, you know, about getting up on a kitchen table, pinching my wife's hand, and you're not going to do that, right? You know, because if you are, you know, and I say, you know what? I would have been all right. But you started this kind of crap before. This is what you're doing now. I mean, I was fine. I just drink a beer, I'll be all right. But no, you got to tell me that I don't behave right. You got to tell me that there's a limit I can have. You know, so I'm mad already. And I get to drinking, and it's going to happen again. Only worse this time, you know, and they ain't going to ask me back. And then I can be mad about that. I can say that I can get drunk because you didn't ask me back. They put everybody else got to ask back the party, not me. Guess I'll go get drunk.
you know?
So I put a whole case together for my drinking. I didn't even know this was happening. As smart as I thought I was, I didn't know it was happening. I mean, I knew that it wasn't right, but I didn't know exactly what was going on, so I kept drinking. The last 3 years of my drinking, all I did was quit drinking. And I drank more than when I was quitting than I ever did when I just drank. My wife tried to stop me from drinking, tried to help me with stopping drinking. I got so sick, my stomach was so bad, that a doctor told me, you gotta quit, you can't drink, you're gonna die, you keep drinking. God almighty. So I smoked marijuana for 6 months till my stomach healed, you know. It was a sacrifice, but you gotta, if you wanna take care of your body, you gotta do something, you know? But my wife had little things. My wife, I think, thought that if you can't be a family, if you got this raging marginal psychopath in a house, you could at least try to look like some kind of a family. So she had her version of what a family ought to be. Now, you got to bear in mind, this girl got to have a couple bolts missing to even get mixed up with somebody like me to begin with, you know. Then to hang in there is something else again. Nobody could love somebody that much. And I'm sure my wife loves me. She must. But it took a little more than that. It was like a challenge or something. But she used to dream up family scenarios and then put them into play. And I'm going to give you, somebody asked me to tell this story, so I'm going to tell it. I haven't told it for a while. But a typical thing in this family values type deal, not to hurt anybody's feelings with that, I got drunk on payday. I used to get paid on Thursday. If you don't get drunk on payday, there's something wrong with your alcoholism. That's what. I mean, I'm not the kind of drinker that wouldn't get drunk on payday. You have to. All the guys get drunk. We don't get drunk. And so then Friday, you have to go out, all them roadhouses, them bands stomping out there. Man, you got to get out there. When you're a young man, hell, you got to go get drunk some more. And then Saturday, I'd get drunk two or three times. You know, I'd get drunk, and I'd come back home, and sometimes I could go right back out. Sometimes I had to get money. Sometimes I had to go in her purse and sneak in her purse and get money. She used to dole my, I hated that. It was so unmanly. She'd hid money from me. She'd get, how much you need for coffee and gas, and take care of that little purse. And I was always feeling guilty that morning when she did that, so I couldn't make my scene yet. And I just hated it. And I'd get money, and I'd go back out and get drunk some more. Well, Saturday, I mean, I'd really, by that time, I'm real bad. Sunday morning, when I come to, it would be her. She'd have a dust mop or something, and she'd take the handle, stick it in my side, and get me up Sunday morning and twist it, and I'd feel that in there, and I'd get up. Now, I got a monumental hangover. I've been drinking, 4 days or something, and I'm sick. And I can't imagine what she wants. You know, what? You know. And we'd have to play that game. You know. And I don't want to play the game. Sometimes I'd have enough strength to holler about the games, shut the games off, and she didn't know what games meant and things like that. Finally she'd get me up and she'd say, you know what you promised us and your daughter. And I'd say, what? You're going to take us to the zoo. So you've got to be kidding me. Zoos stink. Yeah. But I'd go to the zoo. It'd be late by the time it'd get me in so I could move. And I get out of bed, I get a headache, and I'm sick, and I'm shaking. And we go out, and then I'd remember stuff, like my car. Oh, Jesus, I got to get her. Somehow I got to maneuver her into the driver's side because I wrecked the other side, or something like that. I got to get out to the car before she does because there's something in a car she might see. Or maybe there's somebody in the car. I don't know. But I'd worry about that until I got that solved. Then I wouldn't have enough gas. And just the other night, she'd give me $2 for gas or something, and I drank it up. And I don't want to admit it. But I think I can make it to the zoo when it's on E, And God help me if I run out of gas, Because then I don't have no money to get with the can. I don't have money for a deposit on a can. I had to get out of the gas station and give them some, all them times I had to give them some kind of story and leave my watch. And some of them wouldn't take a stinking watch I had. I had Timex with the face broke and everything else. And say, I'll give you a quarter's worth of gas for that son of a bitch, and that's charity at that, But I didn't. Another fiasco would happen. I knew it, But I'd get her out to the car, and we'd all get in there, and we'd go to the zoo. And we'd be late. I always had to park the worst place, somewhere way down. All the big shots, them, they got spots. There's always spots there. You ever notice that? You go to a nice place, there's places to park for real people. Certainly not for you, you jerk. You know, and it seemed to me I'd park and walk up, this blazing sun, and I'm sweating and I'm sick. I got this daughter of mine, and looking back on it, she was a nervous wreck. It just wasn't good to put Mommy and Daddy together on a Sunday after all week long with her on the phone, bar after bar. Is Jack Dempsey there? No, but Gene Tunney is, you know. And she just had it up to there with that, you know. And so we'd get up there, and my wife would manipulate me until I was right in front of that hippopotamus, right up against the cage. And waves of stench from that wretched beast would just wash over me. I was so god-awful sick. I would have been sick in a hospital, let alone in a zoo. And I was standing there, and nausea would just well. And I found something out in those days that I didn't draw on until I got sober in AA, was that if you don't want to throw up, you don't have to. Just do the opposite of AA. Just don't let go, you know? I'd stand there, and it would just well up in air, and I'd fold it in. And my nose would run, and my eyes would water, my ears would ring, but by God, I wouldn't throw up. I wouldn't dare, you know. And people would look at me when I was doing that. And it seemed to me, they would say, "What seems to be your trouble?" God, I hated them. I didn't want help. You know, I didn't want people to help me. Get away from me. You know, because anytime somebody helped me, they helped me get in somewhere where I'm trying to sneak in, not being seen. So, no wonder you have to try. Here's a light. You need a light to get in there. Oh, Christ, you know. And so I didn't do things the way other people did, and I didn't want their help. I didn't want their interference. And I'd be in front of that animal. Now, my wife, and my daughter. My daughter's scared. Over the years, I found these things out. My daughter was afraid to be in this family setting. My wife had no fear. My wife, she's out there where there's officers and every other thing. And certainly this jerk isn't, you know, this is my turf she's on, you know, in a zoo or church or something. This is her turf. And I felt so humbled by that. And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, what am I going to tell her? All the stuff I did in those 3 days are all coming to mind now. Oh, Jesus, you know. I got to call him, you know. And then I'd start to be real sick, and I think, I got to get a drink, or I'll never unscramble what I got to do. And I'm envious of the other guys I know are down here, you know. And after I got sober, I looked at it. When they get out of the club, you know, if I could have went to the club, that's where I wanted to go. Because I had a perception of that club that wasn't true. And I seen that club, I seen the way the clubs were after I got sober. You know, I wanted my daughter, my wife, and me all down there. You know, just let the kid eat potato chips and drink Cokes and sit in a corner of some drafty little bar. And me and Mama would dance and hang on each other, you know, and play the jukebox. And when I was drinking, I thought that was something, you know. I thought, why can't my wife be? I always wanted an alcoholic woman, you know, so we could have DTs together. You know? The alcoholic women were so damn crazy, though. Jesus, you know. When you just talk to them in a bar, I mean, they would say all the right things and just get you all wound up in that, and then they'd meet somebody else at the jukebox and go to Venezuela or some goddamn thing. Or vice versa, you know. They'd tell you, I mean, they were crazy, too. They'd say, well, let's sell one of my kids and get the money, and you and I have really a... Or sell one of yours, you know. Yeah, I can't sell mine. My wife's watching them all the time. But that, you know, that world didn't work. But I wanted to be there instead of that zoo. And I'm looking at my family. My wife's standing there just mad. You can tell she's mad. She just looks mad. She's beet red and clean. She washed all the time. And she took baths all the time. When I would do wrong, she would take a bath. It soothed her, she told me later. And I told her, my limited experience with a little bit of psychology 101, and I told her that rats do that when they're frustrated, you know. And that she didn't accept that as just some idle information. She took that as a personal affront, and she would say sarcastic things. Well, the rat is going to take a shower, you know. And but I had such a problem with that. I'm standing there, and a family of them would come right up beside me, you know. And there I am with maybe a flannel shirt buttoned wrong, two different kind of socks on. You know, I'm not clean. I need a shave. I feel sick. And my wife is just snarling and everything, and there's that daughter over there trying to get in trouble. I know if I took my eyes off her for a minute, she'd be in a lion's cage or something. Somehow she'd get in there or get her foot stuck somewhere or something would happen. And this family would come up, and there was the perfect father, you know, just beautiful guy, you know, with silver in the temples, you know, and steel gray eyes. Kind of guy, you know, if you went up and talked to him in a couple minutes, he could walk you through anything, you know, saying all the trendy words and everything and that. And he would say, "Well, yes, I've been with United States Steel for 20 years, and I built everything. Everything." As opposed to you, Kenny. And he got this woman hanging on, no better looking than my wife, but certainly she wasn't getting her clothes from Goodwill and that. She had nice clothes from that big U.S. Steel salary of his, and she had her hair all fixed up. You know, my wife couldn't leave me alone long enough to run down her hair fixed. And she's clutching on his arm and looking up in them steel gray eyes, adoring him. And I had visions of what she would say if you would ask her, you know. So that, and then have a little boy there, cute little carrot top maybe boy, you know, with freckles and happy, and he's with dad and mom at the zoo. Now, not only do I hate this guy, but I envy the boy. I want a dad like that. I never did, you know. And I thought, boy, we'd take that cute smile off your face and get you down one of the north side bars some Saturday night, you know. You and mama, when somebody grabs her by the hind end, you know. See what you'd do about that, you know. Hey, looking good, honey, you know. And that little boy, he would scamper off, and that father would say, "Johnny," and the kid would stop, turn around, "Yes, Dad." Say, "Come back here," you know, and the kid would come back, and they'd spar a little bit, you know. And the woman would stand there and watch this. And you can imagine her saying, "That's my men, my big man and my little man." Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I'm thinking's going on. My daughter over here, Nancy, my daughter runs off. Now, I can't say Debbie because she wouldn't think it was me. I'm all full of rage, and I'm afraid that she'll get lost or something, and we'll be at this damn zoo longer yet before I get a drink. So I holler, "Debbie!" And instead of her turning around and saying, "Yes, Dad," she runs faster. And my wife would turn on me in front of everybody, the height of embarrassment, and say, don't you scream at that child after what you did. Now, I don't even know what I did. The reports ain't even all in yet, you know. And I certainly don't know what she knows. And that's the difficult part, because I'd already made the mistake of confessing to things that she wasn't involved in that area, because she didn't know. Oh, and any time I ever tried to outsmart her, I always got myself in some kind of a jam, because she was sober. She was sober, and she had chronic sobriety. She could just sit down and plot and think and just cover every base. And as time went on, it got worse, because she could second-guess me, And I'd be drunk, and I wouldn't be up to par, you know. I just couldn't handle her. She was too goddamn smart. And it was just like having a CIA director in the house, you know. One little incident to try to outfox her, I used to leave stuff would be in my car. I mean, there'd be things in my car I want my wife to see. And not to make you think I'm some kind of a Don Juan. I'm talking about anything could be in there. There could be receipts from a finance company where I got a confidential loan, which ain't confidential. If you don't pay it, they tell your whole family you owe it. You know? So they lie, too. But I could have, because when I used to get the money from a loan, I throw all that paperwork over my head. "The party! Man, I'm going in that car, that bullshit paperwork. Hey, if you want your money, call me." You know what I mean? Because I didn't come down here to make payments. I come down here to get money. See? Your problem is the payments. My problem was to get the money. You know, but I have my car. I come home after a long bender, and I thought, you know what? That woman ain't gonna be surprising me with nothing she found in the car tomorrow. So I stopped the car a couple doors away from my house and searched my car. Drunk as I was, I'd done a thorough search, and I could find nothing in there that she would misunderstand. And I went home. I went to bed. She got me up the next morning. She says, "I want to know something." "What?" Because I want to know why the back seat of our car is sitting on the sidewalk in front of Santa. Well, what can you say? I remember being drunk. I remember being so mad at the rest of the world. The rest of the world got away with everything. Me and a drunken buddy of mine, we were walking around. My car broke down, and we were just walking around, drinking. Because he didn't want to go home, I didn't want to go home. So we went to this 5- and 10-cent store, and I go over there, and I wanted to steal something. I hated to go in a place like that without stealing something. Yeah. And so I thought, I'm going to kill two birds with one stone here. I stole earrings, big pack of them. I got them all in my pocket, and we got out of there. And we're going along drinking. It was in the summer, and any car that was open, I'd throw one earring in there. Yeah. Explain that, you Mr. Clean, goody two-shoes. You know? So there's probably guys like that still out there. I'm sure I'm not the originator of that, nor am I the last one to do it. So if any of you girls are having a little trouble finding in your heart to forgive that old SOB, or try to get another look at it, maybe there was some jerk like me and he really didn't do that, you know. Bad chance. You know, you can't get every ounce of cynicism out of them well-worn wives, I'll tell you that. You know. It's good, though, because they never pay too much for stuff and things like that. You know. I was just a wreck, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. God almighty, I couldn't have thought of nothing worse at the time. My wife left me. Can you imagine that? Left. And she was even madder when she found out I didn't know she was gone. And as a matter of fact, that's how I found out she left. She called me to tell me she left again because she had gone. She wanted to feel me out, see if I was back there. So I would. But I was sad, and she had left. And I ended up, there was a neighbor of mine who was going around saying, not today. You know, I drank with him. He was, not today. I'm not drinking today. And boy, I thought that was stupid. But he was doing that, and they're all buzzing about me. They're going to trap me. They're going to have some kind of an intervention or something. Well, nobody could really have an intervention, because I'd have just been in jail. I'd have gotten a fist fight. I'd have punched anybody who said something cool. So it wouldn't have worked. But they have, people can outsmart even just like me, you know. But anyhow, I end up going to AA. I went to AA, my wife came home. AA was tough for me. I come in January 1969. I got sober April 18th, 1970. And in those 14 and 15 months, I got drunk every 4 months. I went to meetings every night. Did the best I can. I took a night or two out to get drunk. But I read the book, and I'd done these things. Now, every time I'd get drunk, I'd come back to AA, and AA would tell me that I didn't have the first step, and I wanted to kill them. And I believed then, and I still believe, that the first step wasn't the thing that was making me get drunk, or not making me get drunk, because we have a problem with God, some of us. There's a chapter to agnostics in the big book, which means that there's a lot of people with that problem. There's no chapter to the sports fans in there. I mean, they're addressing a serious problem within the confines of the alcoholic, you know, and that's where I was. That was my biggest problem. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. That's what made me drunk, because it would dawn on me that I'm powerless over alcohol. What am I fighting? You're powerless over alcohol. It's light. Drink alcohol, succumb, and it goes away. Short period of time. So the first step got me drunk. How about that? Now, the second step was something I couldn't understand because I have an alcoholic mind. See? When they sent me to a psychiatrist, I had to decide what he was going to do for me before I went there. So I thought, let's see, if I tell him everything I've done, he'll be legally liable to turn me in, you know. And so I ain't going to tell him that. And I can't tell him just a little bit of stuff because he'll say, get a hobby and you'll be all right. $100 next. You know, so I told him something in the middle, and Jesus, he thought I was really sick. So that didn't work. So I had that alcoholic thinking, so I had the same thinking with this second step. I heard at every meeting they would get up, and they would say, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves to restore us to sin. And that's not what I heard. That's what they said, that's what I read, but that's not what I heard. What I heard was, you finally believe everything that Methodist minister told you when you're just a little brat. I mean everything. You remember the Apostles' Creed when they'd say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, and in His Son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was conceived of the Virgin Mary and suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The Methodists said that He went straight up to heaven. The Catholics and the Lutherans said He went down into hell, then up to heaven. The Jews said He didn't even come, let alone go. Some of the third world religions said, yeah, He come, but He come and He went back, and He come back as a dove or something. I didn't know what to believe. And I thought that's what they were asking me to believe, and I was having a hard time with it. So I did what they told me to do here. They made me go to meetings. A lot of people get up here and they make a fuss over guys that are sober a long time. I'm going to tell you something. If you're sober out there a year, two years, year and a half, something like that, I'm going to tell you the best thing since sliced bread. If you start beating yourself up about it, I'm only sober a year, and hell, I ain't got a new old yet, and I ain't, you know, and she's still mad at me, and you're doing a good job in here. Because you save people like me. Because them guys, I would go up to them old timers with all my crazy crap. And they would just, they'd look at me and they'd size me up and they'd say, ah, son, you just keep coming to me. You know? And easy does it. What? Hell, you mean easy does it? You know, I'm afraid to go to sleep and my wife is sticking ice pick in my ear. You're telling me easy. Those guys sober a year would say, I don't give a damn what you think. Get in the car, we're going to a meeting. Well, I don't like to go Tuesday night because, get in the car! You know, because they're sick. Them guys with a year's sobriety are still sick and goofy, mean. And they get in there, and they got the two of them in the front, one sober 2 years, he's driving, man. And the other guy's his shotgun and pigeon combination. It's like a combination Bridget and urinal or something, you know. Water fountain in the urinal. Can you imagine that, how popular that would be? And that's the sidekick. He's sitting over there, and then they put the junk in the back, junk guys. Me, and they always have somebody with a set of crutches or something, or, you know, somebody weighs 400 pounds, or they got some girl that wears like an evening dress with a hoop in it or something. You know, just new people that are just crazier than hell, and they're all in the back. All these conversations were on. A guy would say, we're going up to this town, such and such, to go to that meeting. And I'm thinking to myself, when they go to an airport? There's a meeting about 6 blocks away. So sometimes I dare. Why don't we go over this? We're not going over there. We're going up there. We're going to see Bob. I said, what about Bob? Oh, Bob's a great guy. You'll love him. He's sober 8 years. You wouldn't believe this guy. Where do you see him? I was never impressed with Bob when I got there. We get up there and he got Bob, got a pot, got, you know, a cigar. He's got a frayed tie on and everything. What the hell? You know, oh, Bob, you know. I wouldn't dare say nothing bad about Bob. Bob got one tooth here, and they hug when he goes in, and Bob talks to him, you know, and he's all excited. But I went where they told me to go because it was too dangerous not to. And any time a peep come out of you, they'd all jump on it, and they all laugh at each other, and the conversations were ridiculous in there. One guy would say, if I don't get my Martha back, if she doesn't come back to me, God, a man can't live without a woman. I'll drink. I know it. The other guy said, I'm going to drink if I don't get rid of that Judy. And your head's going like this, listening to these conversations. And so, you know, you hear such madness in the car, it becomes evident that you can make your contributions. So I'd make my contributions. This guy would laugh, the other guy would say, Jesus, boy, you sick. Somebody else would say, what do you mean? I'm still doing it. I'm sober 2 years, you know. And it was starting to get all right. The camaraderie, the fellowship, whatever it was starting to work. And by God, as time went on, they'd give me all the right answers. They just didn't say them nice. I'd say something, easy does it, you know. First things first, for heaven's sakes. And then we used to get little scenarios about if somebody's case was really pathetic, and you finally reach these rock-hard SOBs in there about you have a bad thing, they would help you devise a plan to kill them, whoever was, to kill your boss. And it would be all like in sort of sick fun. But they would come up with ideas. So I got an idea. And one guy in the back would say, hey, why about this? Damn, that's funny. We'd all be laughing, thinking about him, thinking, Jesus, I don't want to, that's not a capital crime to be a mean boss, you know? So actually, sober thoughts are starting to come in here, you know? I wanted him to kill that stepfather.
You know, I thought, the only way, I resent him, I hate him, I blame everything on him. We need to go kill him. You know. And, but that, you can't do that. And you can't do any, I can't do anything I want to do sober. I just don't have enough reality hidden to do. I just can't do it. So I was learning the hard way that why a lot of people don't drink. Because they don't want to behave. I don't want to behave like a social drinker. I don't want to. When would somebody without booze in them get up and dance on a table with a lampshade on their head? You know what I mean? I just can't believe that. No straight person would do that. Social drinkers would do something like that occasionally on their birthday or something. But, geez, man. And I went to all these AA meetings and finally this program started to work for me. And a second step come to me. I wasn't in some quiet chapel with the sun streaming through the window that came to believe in God, you know. That's probably sitting on a toilet, you know. I just realized that this program was working for me. It was actually working for me, and the pain of an obsession to drink was being lifted from me. And I got, like, excited about that. And I got all the promises that people were making me in AA, and they didn't mean to be promises, but they were telling me, hey, this is going to work this way. One guy just hardly knew me. He says, I was bitching about finances. He says, 5 years and you'll be out of it. Damn, it was almost to the day. That 5 years, it just, you know, you make the last payment, you know. And it's like over. You're paying this, paying that, and you're manipulating and trying to get it all in, and pretty soon, the last shovel load. You know, I've experienced that thing about that on a plumbing job. You know, I'd be doing a big job, a lot of fittings, and just have everything piped and start soldering and soldering and soldering. And my arms tired from holding that torch up and everything. And finally, there's the last fitting. And I remember saying to a carpenter friend of mine with me, I said, I started the last fitting on a job. I was really tired. We tried to get the people's bathroom ready for the weekend. And I said, it's over. He said, what the hell are you talking about? I says, I made the last joint on it. Well, sure. And I said, but to me, see, I was noticing things. I was noticing that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to stuff. And that guy told me 5 years and damn, them bills weren't done. They were done. I mean, I had bills like everybody else, but I mean, the big load, the borrow from finance companies and the mess I was in. It got over it. I got just the regular problems that everybody else has. And, damn, it was a good experience. And I had to write an inventory and I had to take that fifth step. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to take that fifth step with somebody who was real old and sick and wish they'd die. I didn't want to tell them. And I had to do it. I had to do that step or I'd have never made it. After I took that step, I felt I belonged. Not only in AA, but I felt I belonged in the world. That was the best feeling I ever had in my whole life. I never experienced that feeling of belonging ever as a child or an adult, drunk or sober. But when I did that fifth step, that's how I felt. I was confused about the sixth and seventh step, and I dwelled on them, and AA hollered at me about to make it too much or nothing, and told me that I should get on with amends because that's what I was trying to dodge anyhow by yammering about the sixth and seventh step. So I got into that. It took me 4 or 5 years to make amends to my family, to my satisfaction. Whether they're satisfied, I'm sure they are, but I learned through doing that steps that that's not my problem. My problem is to do the best I can with me, and whatever comes of that, I gotta do. So that's what I'm doing. I had to make amends to my stepfather. I couldn't believe it. It wasn't amends so much to make to him. It was make an effort to confront him with all my stuff with him. I made an appointment to go out and see him. He's dead now, but he lived in Chicago, and I went out to see him. And he knew about my drinking. I drank with him as I got a little older there, and he knew all about that. But I went out and I told him, I said, you know, the AA's made me take an inventory about my situation with him before I went out. So I was only 12 years old, and anybody could make a case for a 12-year-old, what the hell, it's nothing, it's his fault, it's all the day. But that's not the case. He wanted to change. He was a proud man. He wanted to change my name to his. I wouldn't do it. And it really was a thrust at my natural father that I wouldn't do it. It wasn't anything. But he probably took that personally. As a matter of fact, he brought it up in our conversation.
I wouldn't let him have that. And he was a very proud man and with a drinking problem to begin with. And that was a serious infraction there. And I didn't realize that until I took my own initiative. The other thing was I tried to break that marriage up between him and my mother. I tried to be everything for my mother. I tried to clean the place, do whatever I had to do. He is not necessary. I tried to make him not necessary. And I'm sure he sensed that. But I got sober in AA and I badmouthed him and Lise. Early on, I really talk about him because I hate him. And I told him about that. I told him about the stuff as a child. I told him about the lease. He said, you're in that A&A or whatever it is a couple years by this time. He said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, you're doing pretty good. He said, don't worry about all that old stuff. He said, that's water over the dam. He said, you're in that AA now, and you haven't been coming out here and didn't know you were out here. Remember that? He told me a few stories about me getting on a bus and just going out there and getting all drunk and being in a blackout. I was surprised when my mother opened the door. One time I opened the door, I said, Mom, what are you doing here? I didn't know where I was. She said, what do you mean, what am I doing here? I live here. What are you doing here? But he got some laughs out of that incident. But he said, you're not doing that anymore, and your wife's not calling here, writing anymore, complaining and being scared about what you're going to do or did. He said, at AA, you're sober now. He says, and you bought a nice house out there, and that was Monroeville area, and he called it Manureville, and you got a nice little ranch-type home like everybody else, and you got a nice car, and he said, I'm going to tell you something. He says, I'm proud of you. He never, ever said anything like that. Christ didn't. He says, I'm going to tell you why I'm proud of you. I thought maybe you'd find out some of the good work I did in AA, helping and everything, you know. He says, I'm proud of you because I made you what you are today. I bust out laughing, and he laughed too. But you know, it took it out. It took that bar that was in my stomach that was hate. It took it out of there because he became real when he said that. That was his way. He did all he could. He did what they did then. His dad knocked the shit out of him. And he was just tickled pink that I survived and contributed what his way of bringing a boy up. Bringing a boy up into a manly man is the way they did that. And the results is what you got. You got a guy up here today who probably, you know, like I got some of my defects of character are real bad scars, and they're probably never going to go away. So until a whole generation of them turd birds like myself are out of the way, you're always going to have people leaning toward the chauvinistic side and stuff like that. I understand intellectually what I should do. And sometimes that's a burden because I don't have the spirit to be sensitive and to put myself out, you know. It's not me, you know. I do the best I can. I say, yeah, you know. But I learned that about him, and I seen him as a real human being at that kitchen table. And hey, I'm not telling you him and I run out and fish together and everything. I still don't like him, you know. But the thing was that the hate was gone, and he became real. And I understood that everything he did, he thought he was doing the right thing. And as a matter of fact, I'm grateful that I give him a couple years before he died the glow that comes from what he thought, because I know he thought he made it. He did this. And he was proud of the grandkids, you know. Mike, look at the way that Jack raised his girls. God damn, one of them got a master's degree, blah, 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 blah. Just, you know. And so it worked. You know, it worked. It worked the relationship with him. It worked. It took the heat off my mother, you know. And AA has given me everything I have. There's nothing I give. My sponsor's the best friend for years, you know, and I have my pigeons sponsor me now since they got enough sobriety. So my sponsor gets out of town. And I utilize the people that know me best to be my sponsor. They always stop me when I'm going the wrong direction or help me. And I go to meetings on a regular basis, and when I get asked to talk at something like this, I really feel privileged and proud to be here. And it's really refreshing. Anybody that hasn't traveled a lot, you find out no matter where you go, AA is great. And AA is it just makes life worth living. And I think that's some of the biggest job for a person that's getting on, you know. I remember saying something to a young kid one time. I'm looking at him. He come to a meeting. He's all crabby and everything. He's sober about a year. Nice looking young fella, you know, built like a damn Greek god and everything.
And he says to me, he says, boy, I'm bad shape, man. I'm having a bad day. As a matter of fact, a bad week. I said, how'd you like to wake up tomorrow morning and be a 55-year-old bald-headed fat guy? And he didn't see the connection right away. He thought about what I said. He said, Jesus Christ. I said, well, that's what I'm going to do. And I says, I'm happy as hell here today. I want to tell you that I'm happy as hell to be here. God bless you.